Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with bassist, composer, producer, and educator, Lauren Cohen. He just released his first solo album as a leader with the 2015 release of Home featuring the legendary Joe Locke on the vibes. Over the course of our conversation, he talked candidly about many things and with passion. From trips around the globe with cats like Monty Alexander and Joe Locke, growing up in Chicago, moving to New York City to further his jazz dreams, along with why he loves jazz so much and a whole lot more. Dig it, my friends.
Thank you for taking a little time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Nice to connect. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, thank you. And I'm just going to go ahead and dive right in and ask you, amongst other things, you have your newest release as a leader with Joe Locke called Home. Along with that album, what else has been going on with you lately?
Well, I've been playing with Joe Locke. I've been playing with Monty Alexander for about 4 years. And then I've been playing with Joe Locke most recently, since I moved to New York about 2 years ago. And then various other people in New York, but those are sort of the big, and then with Ryan Cohen as well. But basically the last year, I've been really working on this project. In addition to working, continuing as a sideman in New York, different people, but Monty and Joe have been the two probably biggest names that I've been doing recently. And so those are this project is the main thing I've been working on. I'm also in graduate school, getting my master's in music right now. Just doing sideman work. I've been playing on Motown the Musical here in New York, playing the show, actually subbing in on that show, and then just staying busy,
Yeah, absolutely. So what's it like to work with cats like that that are so well-versed and journeyed and have so many years behind them?
Well, I mean, both those guys, the interesting thing that somehow I connected both those guys is they're both, first and foremost, they're two of the top players on their instruments in the history of their instruments. Monty Alexander, in my opinion, one of the greatest piano players in the history of jazz. And Joe Locke, period, in my opinion, the premier, without a doubt, vibraphonist today. So on one level, they can, as we would say, deal. And they can play more vibes, more piano, and than anybody. But what they also understand is connecting to an audience and communicating without coddling. In other words, Monty Alexander nourishes a crowd. People want him. He's not he's not hurting for work because he gives people what they need through music, which is what music should give them. Which is unfortunately most jazz is very exclusive. Most jazz today alienates people. They don't relate to it. I believe that this music, when it's the best, anybody will relate to it. And both Joe and Monty can, your average civilian who's never heard jazz before, because of the power, again, because they can take care of business on their instruments, but the power of their performance, and they're gonna bring people in. They're inclusive. So I've been lucky to share the bandstand with guys like that understand that, understand the communication element of this music, that it's not just about playing, and it means nothing unless you can connect with people and move people emotionally. And so that's something that I've learned a lot from them, and among other things. But that's something that I really wanted to, inform my music with. And Monty, for example, is very old school in that there's no rehearsal, there's no discussion. He just hits the bandstand and starts playing, and you either sink or swim. And he doesn't read music. There's no sheet music. So that's a dying, that experience is virtually long gone, where it's just you hit the bandstand and go. Yeah. And so musically for me, that was very profound, just having to deal on that level. Joe's different. Joe likes to rehearse, but Joe's also, he's been out here a long time, and both these guys played with a lot of different people, and so there's just a very high level of seasoning with both those guys that I've tried to glean from to a certain extent.
Absolutely. Yeah, probably would be hard not to with people like that.
So you were raised outside of Chicago in Lincolnwood in an artistically rich home, as your bio says. What was your childhood like to give you this love of music and more specifically of jazz?
Well, as I say in the liner notes, my mother filled the house with art and music. My mother is mad about music and art, and that awakened my soul. And my mom was a music teacher. She has a master's. She has two master's degrees, actually. She has a master's degree in music and a master's degree in art history. So for her, she sees the world entirely through the prism of the arts and culture. And so our home was, literally there was a radio in Chicago, the classical music station called WFMT. And WFMT was literally going 24 hours a day. And I used to impersonate Studs Terkel when I was a little kid, because that was the sound of Friday night. And besides that, I'm the youngest of four, and my other brother Elliot was a guitar player. And it's just, you know, it's a different day and age now. Nowadays, kids there's not even an exposure to playing instruments, unfortunately. When I was growing up, you know, in the 80s, becoming a musician, which was kind of the 80s, everybody was playing. Everybody, my brother was a guitar player, and then Ryan Cohn, my cousin, was a piano player, so we needed a bass player. And and everybody was jamming. You know, my brother was just, we were into music. I mean, by the time, when I was 11 years old, you know, the first thing that ever really hit me was, I used to hear this reggae band down in Florida, but I was always into music. And we were always just talking about music and obsessed with music. And I think it's a different age now. I don't see a lot of young kids where it's like music and just being obsessed with that as a part of who they are. But so my brother played guitar and we would jam all the time. Ryan played piano. My mom was obsessed with music. And that was the environment that I grew up in, you know?
Yeah.
So it was very, very rich and fertile in that way.
Absolutely. So speaking of as a kid, you started out on the alto sax in fourth grade.
Correct.
And then you went to the bass at 14. Why did you make that switch from horn to bass?
Well, I started on horns because, you know, in fourth grade, we all had to go pick an instrument for band. And I really at that point, I was not listening to the jazz at all. I had no knowledge of jazz. I was just sort of forced to pick an instrument. So it wasn't really, I wasn't really playing a lot of jazz on it. I started playing bass because I got really into, there was this sort of pressure from my cousin and my brother, where it was like, all right, we need a bass player. And then I was really into Chicago blues. And living right outside of Chicago, and my brother was into that. So I got really into the blues, and I just got into the bass. When I look back on it now, and soon afterwards, I realized that the reason I love the bass is because I wanted to make people dance. Like, I just thought the coolest thing was to be playing the bass for a big party and making everybody groove, you know?
Yeah.
And so that became my entry point into jazz as well, because I came to jazz through Ray Brown. And Ray Brown, when I first heard him, it was just, all right, it wanted to make me dance. Prior to Ray Brown, I had heard it was like Jaco and all the fusion guys. But when it was more straight ahead jazz, I came to it from this feeling of, with Ray Brown, it was just a groove, you know, it's going to rock no matter what, you know, and you're going to stomp your feet. And that's how I came to it. And then through Ray Brown, that's how I became aware of Monty Alexander, et cetera. But the bass for me was about rocking the house, you know?
Yeah.
And then I started to get into more other styles of music. But it's still, that's what it's about for me, is bass. A bass player needs to be able to groove.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's the function of the bass. And, you know, nowadays you can go on YouTube and see all these, especially with the electric bass players, unbelievably flashy soloists But for me, it's all about it's all about the groove and making people want to move, you know, in some way.
Absolutely. So when you were a kid, what did you dream that you were going to be when you grew up? Was it always music or was it something else?
It was always music. My first hero was John Patitucci, and I was very heartened, actually, yesterday. There was a review that came out of actually another Missouri guy, John Poses, wrote a little, it wasn't much of a review, but he just sort of mentioned, the only thing that made me happy about it was he mentioned my album and John Patitucci's album in the same breath, you know, and that for me was like, because Patitucci was my hero in terms of bass, and Patitucci and Jaco. But I always, initially, it was like I wanted to be, I think many musicians feel this same thing, is the idea of a studio musician. Like, the idea of the studio musician is the coolest thing, because when you're a kid, you want to be loved by everybody, you know, and you're aware that, like, studio musicians, oh, they're the man, you know, like, they're their phones, you know, is always ringing, and they're always working. And in Chicago, in the 80s, there was a very thriving studio music team. Chicago was a big city for jingles, and a lot of the people that were older than me and kind of that I was studying with, that's what they were doing. You know, they were doing jingle dates. And I thought, oh, man, that'd be the coolest thing to, like, have your, you know, to be able to, you're listening, you're watching TV and there's a commercial and you're playing bass on that. Well, sure enough, that whole scene died out. But initially that was it. And then it became, but it was always music. It was always music. I mean, I it's like an addiction, you know, it bit me from a young age. And, I think there's many other things that I could do. But it's always the music.
Right on. So, obviously, since you were close to Chicago, is there the blues always kind of close to your heart?
Oh, yeah, man. And that's the blues for me are it's like, again, in the liner notes, I say there are kind of three on the album. There are sort of three locations that inform the music. And Chicago was number one. I mean, the blues for me was Chicago blues, which is like, you know, electric guitar style, Buddy Guy-esque style of blues. That was, you know, we were sneaking out, my brother and me, we were sneaking into you know, all the blues bars to see these guys, and that was my first big influence, and that's still a huge influence on me. I mean, the blues is it's still a huge influence on me. I'll never be one of these guys who you know, there's all kinds of wonderful jazz out here, but for me it's always going to be a part of the music.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let me go back in your lineage to 2005 when you toured the world with Monty Alexander. You talked about him a little bit, but at that age and that stage of your life, that had to be huge to see that much geography and to feel that much music.
Oh, yeah. It was incredible. I mean, well, I did my first gig with him in 2005. Again, I became a huge fan of Monty's. Because I was listening to Ray Brown, and they have a long association. I started hearing all about this guy, Monty Alexander. I started hearing him on all of Ray Brown's records. So whenever he would come to Chicago, I was always there. Always, you know, the jazz showcase in Chicago. I basically had like they used to say if they had they should have had like one of those punch cards where you could just, you know, get a free visit after 10. Because I was there all the time. And at a certain point, I gave Monty a CD and some stuff I recorded, and I recorded one of his songs. And he was nice enough to check it out, and he called me and he said, I'll put you on the list. And sure enough, I don't remember when it was, maybe 6 months later, he called me to do one date in Switzerland. So we did that. Then the real run was 2007 through 11. That's when we went everywhere. I mean, from Russia 3 times, Morocco, Europe, all over Europe, you know, Bogota, Colombia, Cape Verde, I mean, just, you know, little islands off the coast of Sicily. So it was an unbelievable experience and some of the greatest experiences in my life, not only to see, I mean, traveling as a musician, traveling to play music is probably the greatest thing for me personally that I feel I could do with my life. But also to be able to see how musicians like Monty are received throughout the world was pretty incredible. I mean, seeing him in this tiny island off the coast of Sicily called Lipari, which is like out of a movie. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. They made him the mayor for the day, and being in Tangier and playing in this this old Moorish castle, and then, I mean, it was, you know, this man lives it. I mean, Monty's what now, 70, 72, 73. Right now, he's tonight probably playing, doing the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
But it is an incredible, incredible experience, and I feel very, very grateful to have had that. Not only for the sightseeing element of it, but musically, that's the way this music, that's the way the musicians grow playing this music, is by playing it all the time. And so it was a wonderful experience.
And you got to do the same thing with Joe Locke and with the Ryan Cohen Quartet as well. You went to
with Ryan,
Africa.
We've done a bunch of, yeah, we went to Africa, we went to Russia once, and similarly, you know, incredible. With Joe, I went to Japan earlier this year, which was amazing. I mean, long history of jazz musicians going to Japan. The reception for the music there is and the reverence for the music is very, very high. And so these are always experiences that are to be treasured, without a doubt.
Absolutely. So you arrive in New York City in 2012 from Chicago.
Correct.
What was that like? Was there any kind of culture shock or any kind of, you know, or did you just kind of hit your feet running in New York and just got immersed in, you know, what?
There was some culture shock. There was some culture shock, and some of that, you know, there's many stories to this album. There's this overriding theme of home, because I wanted to pay tribute to my home. There's also this sort of story, which I don't really talk about much, which is sort of me finding home. And there's a lot of the music is inspired by this transition. For example, there's a song called Finding Center, which was just this moving. You're just moving. Everything's in flux. And I left Chicago, which was my comfort zone, you know, and I was very comfortable there. And then you're coming to New York, where, you know, this city is relentless and will just, you know, if you're coming from a place where you're very comfortable, New York will immediately disabuse you of that comfort. So there certainly was definitely some time where it's just a transitional period. But New York, I couldn't have made this record had I not come to New York for a variety of reasons. I would never have connected with a lot of these musicians. Victor Provost, the steel pan player, the harmonica player. I'd always wanted to make a record with steel pan and harmonica. But in Chicago, I just didn't have access to those guys. I mean, I certainly would have known. The thing about coming to New York is, you know, it's not only about New York anymore. There's a whole sort of mid-Atlantic nexus now of jazz, where you have New York still being obviously a mecca, but there's also, you're connected to, there's musicians coming back and forth from D.C., from Baltimore, from Philly, and so like Victor Provost, for example, lives in Washington, D.C., So in other words, it's opened me up to a lot of other musicians and a lot of other experiences. It's not the easiest place to live, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, if you're a musician and a jazz musician especially, it's where you're going to test your mettle.
Yeah.
And, so there definitely was a little shift, and there's some of that in that music. You know, the song "The Hero's Journey," the vibe of it for me has this New Yorkish element, and a lot of that is this idea of this triumph. You know, you're just pushing for this goal, and you're triumphing. You know, the idea of triumph, and then the song "Crossing" is this idea, for me, relates to this idea of, again, it's a crossing. You're moving on to a different threshold of your life, and it's a very scary thing. And it can be a very discomforting thing. It's a cliche, but we only grow when we leave our comfort zone. And
yeah.
that moment of that period where you're in between and things are uncomfortable and there's some of that in this music, like finding center. That's where that moment where you're in between zones is like you don't really know where your center is. And that song has a lot of blues element to it, but it's also got this, so it's like sort of connecting this blues thing from Chicago, but then it has this very, this vamp that was just specifically that I just heard Joe Locke playing on. And it's like, you're in a groove now, you know, but it's like, you're in this moment where you're not really here nor there. So there's that element in this music as well, sort of finding home, you know, there was that time for me where I was in between homes and trying to figure out how I was going to make my home here. So that's my very long-winded answer there, man. Sorry.
No, no, that's cool, man. That's great. It's great expose. And I'm curious, is being in a town like New York that embraces jazz as much as it does, I'm sure that you have to be on the top of your game. What's the best compliment that you've probably received from a show that you've had in New York from a fan?
I mean, for me, the best compliment I can get from a fan is just somebody say, wow, you know, I've never really listened to jazz before, but this really, really moved me. And I've had people say to me just personally, you know, man, wow, you don't seem like the other jazz musician. You know, all the other jazz musicians seem so dark and, you know, so overly serious, and you're smiling all the time and you really look like you're having fun. And so as far as compliments from a fan, I would say those sorts of things are things that I've gotten. For me, this music is about joy, and playing the music is when I'm the happiest I ever am in life.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I heard Joey DeFrancesco say once, when he got turned on to the, B3, he walked into a club and his dad was playing B3, and he said it was the best feeling I'd ever had with my clothes on. And you know, when you hear great music, I mean that's the way it should be. Unfortunately, a lot of jazz nowadays, again, it alienates the listener, you know, and they don't just feel that. And I feel like good jazz is like good anything. It should hit you like. Same way that Jimi Hendrix is going to hit you when you walk in and hear Jimi Hendrix. I mean, great jazz is the same way, you know? So I would say that.
Speaking of good jazz, was there ever a jazz album that just floored you that you think, you know, in your formative years early on, you're like, man, that thing just moved me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, too many to list. But I would say early on, early on it was Jaco Pastorius' first album. That was the first album that really turned me on to, even though it wasn't like straight ahead swinging jazz, that still is one of my favorite albums in terms of, it was a big influence on this album in terms of Jaco was such a genius because he had a voice and he had a point of view coming from South Florida, which he basically, Jaco brought the street sounds that he heard in South Florida together with New York. And so that record was a huge influence and an influence on this record, actually, in many ways. But then as far as just straight ahead swinging jazz, I know everybody's just kind of blue, and of course all the great masterworks are all there, but for me it was an album with Ray Brown, Jeff Hamilton, and Gene Harris called Live at the Loa. And actually, Ryan Cohn, he said, man, you've got to check this out. He said, if you want to start playing acoustic bass, you got to check this out. And that was my first taste of straight-ahead jazz, like really bringing together this element of groove with Ray Brown, just making you want to get up and dance, say amen. And then the blues element, which I connected to. Gene Harris. I mean, all those guys are blues players, but Gene Harris especially was probably one of the greatest blues piano players, blues/jazz piano players But then moving on to more modern things, I would say probably one of my favorite of all time is Pat Metheny's Still Life Talking, which is a perfect album, I think. It's perfect in every way. It's romance. It's just off the top of my head, I would say those three. And then, of course, all the great standard examples we all love, you know, the Kind of Blue, Love Supreme, all that stuff. But those three in particular were kind of milestone albums for me that I still relate to a lot.
So let's say late at night after a show, you walk outside, you got the Back to the Future Jazz DeLorean. You can go back in time and watch any show, one mm-hmm. jazz show. What would you want to go see?
Well, even though I mentioned all these guys, for me it would be something with Coltrane, Coltrane or Jaco, because I consider them both in the same category. But I would have liked to have been able to experience the Coltrane aesthetic in person.
Yeah,
because that was a real. I think in his later years, of course, when it became more of a spirituality. A spiritual component to it. I think a lot of that is somewhat lost on the recording, but I have a feeling if you were alive to witness that and see basically almost see vapors coming out of his horn, that would have been incredible. And then as such a huge Jaco nut, I would have loved to have seen Jaco, man, and particularly before his downfall.
Yeah.
It was a very short, very small window, basically like 1976 through like 83. But, I would love to see, to experience either of those concert with either of those gentlemen.
Yeah. So now that you're a teacher, when you look back on your life, who do you think has taught you the most about either music or jazz?
Wow. That's a great question. I'd have to say as far as music, I'd have to put my mom just right at the top of my head. That'd be my mother, because she instilled, the first thing she perceives is, the passion and the emotion. And that's how she filters. That's how she perceives music. And I think there's a tendency as we get older, to lose that. And the soul, you know, she'd always talk about, to me, is Yasha Heifetz, you know, you play one note and kill you. And there was always that element too of my, this pride. There's always this element of this pride in the Jewish musical tradition, which, you know, is not only just the cantorial thing, but also how these guys were sort of, they were, you know, yeah, for my mom, Yasha Heifetz, Itzhak Perlman, Horowitz, they were singing this song, that was this secularized version of this spiritual longing, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was something that I would say that was the first thing. And then as far as other teachers, I would say Monty Alexander is somebody that I've learned, nothing that he ever told me specifically, but just sharing the bandstand with him, I learned so many values about what music should be, you know, and what music should, and how to be a band leader and how to communicate with an audience. Ryan Cohen, who's on my album, is my cousin and colleague. He's also one of the most brilliant, brilliant musical minds on the planet, and very analytical musical mind, and I've learned so much from him. He's a Guggenheim fellow. You know, the next step for him is like a MacArthur Genius Award, but I've been fortunate to ride his coattails a little bit, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him, because I'm a real ear player. I basically learn by ear, and I'm not a very analytical type of a musical mind. Music is a language and a science. When you start getting into composition, classical composition, it becomes very scientific almost. My mind never really works that way. And that's one reason why I think Monty and I connected, was because, you know, Monty doesn't even know Modes. I mean, I remember when we were in that little island. These islands off the coast of Sicily are called the Aeolian Islands.
Yeah.
And the Aeolian is the natural minor scale, you know. And I remember saying, "Hey, Monty, man, we better play a lot of Aeolian mode tonight." And he was like, "I don't even know. What do you mean?" Like, he didn't even know what that scale was, you know.
Sure.
And
sure.
I know a little bit. I mean, I know what my modes are. I can read music. I know this, but I've never considered. I've always gravitated to everything through my ear, you know. And somebody like Ryan, his capacity for intellectual analysis of the music. It's something I've learned a lot from.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, speaking of kind of sentimentality a little bit, what's the greatest thing about waking up every day for you?
Oh, wow, man. Greatest thing about waking up is, wow, man. What a great question. The greatest thing about waking up is, I guess, on one level, just waking up, you know?
Yeah.
The fact that that we're here and that you're alive. And another thing, you know, music is, Howard Blakey said, music wipes away the dust of life. And hopefully the greatest thing about waking up is hopefully that day I'm going to be able to play some music. Because music does. Life is suffering. Life is hard. And music really wipes that away. Unfortunately, and I mean, so get back to your question because I can wrap poetic here. But for me, it's just on one level, so I'm just thankful to be alive. And then the greatest part of my day is hopefully I'll have more opportunity to make music today. You know,
right on.
Create.
Yeah. Well, and kind of getting back to what you were saying before, why do you love jazz?
I love jazz because it allows me the greatest amount of it allows me to express myself and to express my creativity in the most expansive form, in the most expansive manner, as opposed to, I love all styles of music, but jazz will allow you to express yourself in whatever way you want to. There's the element of improvisation, which is an ocean. Besides rhythm, the other thing that I gravitated to very early was harmony, jazz harmony, the rich color, rich range of harmony that jazz musicians employ, which, you know, now many people will say, well, classical musicians were using those same harmonies 100 years earlier, and I guess that's true. But for me, the rich, and I feel the same way about classical music, the rich texture, the rich harmonic palette, it's akin to like eating McDonald's hamburger or eating a wonderfully prepared, beautifully prepared, homemade meal, you know?
Yeah.
Because I hear a lot of people, I'll be on the subway and I'm hearing what people are listening to, and quite honestly, a lot of it to me doesn't even, it is barely definable as music. I don't mean to sound like an old timer here because I love all music, but we're reaching a point now where a lot of what people are listening to, I don't even know if it can be called music anymore. I mean, yes, there's a rhythm, you got a beat that repeats, and somebody's spitting rhyme over it, which is rhythmical, but it's not necessarily musical. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So to me, jazz is the most, it's the musicality of it. And I think that jazz is more important now than ever because as human beings, music, I think as human beings, the arts are what define us. And I would even argue that music being the most important element of the art that defines us as human beings, especially in the digital age, where everything's becoming so much more digitized, that if we want to maintain a soul, it's becoming more important. It's not even becoming it's becoming imperative now that people listen to music.
Yeah.
Because music is, you know, if you go to the Apple store and see 500 people sitting around waiting to get their phones fixed, it's like, at what point, where's the soul going to go? What's going to happen to the human soul here? And I think music nourishes that. And I think jazz, for me, is the most sophisticated expression of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, sorry, man. I get a little long-winded there.
No, that's cool. No, I love it, man. I love it. It's awesome. It's yeah. Wisdom. Let me ask you this. In 10 years, we interview again, and I say, tell me what's been going on. What are you going to be happy to tell me happened?
Well, I hope that in 10 years, they can have at least another two albums out. I hope to have another huge project of mine that I really... Moving on now from this album, I want to explore more. I have a love for lyrics and singers, and so I want to explore music that involves more singers. And I want to incorporate one long thing that I want to do is I have this idea of sort of becoming the Anthony Bourdain of music. I don't know if you know Anthony Bourdain has these travel shows where he uses food as an entry point into culture. And this is a project that I've sort of had the back burners for a while. But I would love to do some sort of similar series where traveling the world and using music as a way of looking at culture. Because for me, when you ask me what my reason for waking up in the morning, the ultimate goal and meaning for me of being a musician, besides jazz, besides anything, is to connect people and to learn about other cultures. And jazz is our American export, but there are expressions, every culture, in the same way that every culture has their own food, every culture has their own style of music that expresses the culture. And to me, the greatest thing of beyond jazz, beyond any style, the greatest thing is to be able to connect with another culture and communicate through music. And so ideally, bridge gaps and bridge divides, you know, and that would be something in 10 years if I was able to say to you, man, you know, I've traveled here, I've made some inroads, I've been able to show that music can break down barriers between people. And it's not even about jazz. Like, yeah, I'm a jazz, I love playing jazz, but this is, hey, I'm in the Palestinian territories, and yeah, I'm Jewish, but me and this oud player, you know, just did a record, man, and we're showing that this is what breaks down barriers. That, to me, is the greatest calling for a musician.
Absolutely. So, as a man of eloquence and words, I want you, and my final question here,
yes, sir.
For you to define yourself in the length of a tweet, 144 characters, if we need to find out who you are and hit the jugular of the reality of things, tell me who you are.
Okay, so
You can fuck a little bit.
I don't know if I'll get in the exact Twitter words, but Lauren Cohn is a musician that makes music that sticks to your ribs, that makes music that will move you and will move your soul. That's about it.
Perfect. Thank you for your time. This was refreshing. I love catching up with you guys and kind of getting the skinny, and man, you gave it to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the call, man.
Thanks, Warren.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Lauren Cohn for his dedication, enthusiasm, and tasty jazz. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store or visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.